From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, April 29, 2009. The Supreme Court hears a critical case on the Voting Rights Act that could reverse years of increased access for minority voters. Government officials confirm the first known swine flu death as the World Health Organization warns we've moved one step closer to a pandemic. And we'll take you to El Salvador, where deportations from the United States are fueling gang violence. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. economy contracted again in the first quarter of 2009, according to new numbers released today by the Commerce Department. The 6.1% gross domestic product decrease is only a slight improvement over last quarter's drop. In other financial news today, the U.S. House passed a reconciled version of the Obama administration's $3.44 trillion budget. The bill is now in the Senate's hands and could be on Obama's desk by this evening for signing, a move that would significantly cap Obama's first 100 days in office. President Obama will hold a press conference this evening to discuss his first months in office. The Obama administration also called on Congress today to put an end to the disparity in crack and cocaine sentencing. Historically, jail sentences relating to crack offenses have been much larger than for cocaine, a difference many chalk up to economic and racial bias in the system. A United Nations tribunal in Lebanon released four senior Lebanese generals today, detained for their alleged involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The men had been held for 4 years without trial. Jackson Ahlers reports from Beirut.
In issuing the generals' release, the special UN tribunal said, quote, the evidence was insufficient to continue holding the four officials, end quote. All four generals held prominent security positions in Lebanon during Syria's 29-year military presence here and were jailed when an anti-Syrian government backed by the United States assumed control following Hariri's death. Gunfire from AK-47s could be heard throughout Beirut today as the generals' supporters celebrated the UN tribunal ruling. Beirut-based political analyst Asim Kauzali said the UN tribunal decision cast doubt over the widespread allegations that pro-Syrian elements were to blame for Hariri's death. He says that there is evidence that suggests other groups may be responsible.
There have been information about radical Islamists being involved for the assassination of Hariri and other political players in the region.
Kauzali also says the ruling is a victory for the Hezbollah-led opposition that had for 4 years called for the release of the generals. Meanwhile, one expert working with the tribunal told FSRN that despite today's ruling, the generals could still be indicted in a later phase of the UN tribunal. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
African countries have become the first today to respond favorably to Zimbabwe's pleas for financial assistance. They have extended a $400 million U.S. dollar credit line to help the country revive its crippled industrial sector. Southern and Eastern African countries provided the money. FSRN's Moses Magadza has the details.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Commerce, Professor Welsh Mengube, says the credit line will be available to companies which are now operating at an average 10% capacity. Mube told Zimbabwe state media that the Southern African Development Community and the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa provided the funds. Despite its recent troubles, economists have upheld Zimbabwe as one of the few diversified economies in Southern Africa. They say with a strong financial injection and good management, the country's economic turnaround could be sooner than expected. Leaders of Zimbabwe's unity government have appealed for $5 billion in aid, but the international funds have been slow to come. Today's credit lifeline from African countries comes at a time when Western donors are squirming under the global financial crisis. Many are withholding aid until the new government pushes through broad political and economic reforms. They are also calling for an end to a new round of land redistribution trained at the country's few remaining white commercial farmers. Human Rights Watch today also urged countries not to give development aid until the government ends human rights abuses. Moses Magadza, Free Speech Radio News.
Barrick Gold, the world's largest pure gold company, held their annual general meeting in Toronto this morning, where their world headquarters is located. But the shareholders received a hostile reception from a group of Canadian, South American, and Pacific Islander protesters. From Canada, Aaron Lakoff reports.
Dozens of people demonstrated outside the Metro Convention Center this morning, calling for an end to alleged destructive mining practices by Barrick in countries around the world. Sakura Saunders, one of the protest organizers, is critical of the power that Barrick Gold wields both at home and abroad.
They also have one of the most powerful board of directors in the world, which includes Brian Mulroney, the former Prime Minister of Canada. They're extremely influential in Canadian foreign policy and have recently been implicated for having influenced the Harper government's response to the roundtables on the extractive industries.
The demonstration was led by two people from communities directly affected by Barrick mining operations, one from Papua New Guinea and the other from Chile. According to protest organizers, hundreds of army troops in Papua New Guinea are acting on Barrick situation reports. The troops have recently entered the Porgera region neighboring one of the gold mines and have burnt down 80 houses. The company declared nearly $8 billion in sales in 2008. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
A 23-month-old infant is the first known casualty of the swine flu in the United States. The Texas toddler died in Houston Monday night from pneumonia caused by the flu. Government officials confirmed Tuesday that at least 91 people around the nation are carrying the virus, also known as AH1N1. The infant arrived in the Texas border city of Brownsville after crossing from Matamoros just over the U.S.-Mexican line in early April. At a Homeland Security Committee hearing today, Senator John McCain questioned Rear Admiral Ann Shukit, Interim Deputy Director for Science and Public Health Program at the Centers for Disease Control, what circumstances would justify closing the border to stop the virus from spreading.
What conditions would prevail that would say we need to close the border between the United States and Mexico, if any?
I don't think there are any.
Shukit added that closing borders would add no value in stopping the spread of the deadly virus. She spoke during one of three swine flu hearings scheduled this week on the Hill. Meanwhile, newly confirmed Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says the federal government is working to develop a vaccine to guard people in the U.S. against the new strain. Sebelius says her department, along with the FDA, will monitor the new vaccine's safety.
HHS and the Food and Drug Administration will monitor the manufacturing of a potential vaccine and conduct strict oversight to ensure that the vaccine is safe and effective for use.
Scientists are rushing to develop the flu shot, which may be available in a few months. Until then, officials say the swine flu will continue to spread, and the World Health Organization warned today that the world is now one step closer to a pandemic. The WHO held an emergency session in Geneva today to assess the spread of the virus. Dr. Keiji Fukada is the Assistant Director General for the WHO.
This was originally a swine influenza virus, a new swine influenza virus, but it is now behaving more or less like a human influenza virus, with transmission going from person to person.
The Health and Human Services Department, along with the Centers for Disease Control, have created a website where you can read more about planning and preparing for the spread of the virus, www.pandemicflu.gov. That's pandemicflu.gov. The Supreme Court heard a crucial case on the Voting Rights Act today. The High Court could decide to roll back the landmark legislation that has improved access to the polls for minority voters. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell was at today's oral arguments and files this report.
Advocates hail the Voting Rights Act of 1964 as the single most important piece of civil rights legislation. Ryan Haygood is with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
The Voting Rights Act really brought into force the full spirit and effect of the right to vote enshrined in the 15th Amendment and was the key tool in protecting that right, which lay dormant for some time.
Protecting that right is what brought dozens of people to rally outside the Supreme Court, including Bobby Jones from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
At one of our voting polls, and a way to frighten off voters, discourage participation in the voting process, which is one of the only process of equality that minorities have on some levels. They had a coffin that symbolize the President Obama.
Bobby Jones says that instance proves that voting protection is still necessary. And that's what the Supreme Court will decide, whether congressional reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006 was needed. Specifically, the High Court is looking at Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It designates certain states, mainly in the South, with a history of minority voter disenfranchisement, as pre-clearance states. Those states and counties must receive Justice Department approval before any changes to their voting procedures are made. A district in Austin, Texas, wants to bow out from federal oversight, but the district court said it's unable to because Congress did not designate voting districts. Only counties and states can apply for exemption.
The basic burden is, right, that when these gentlemen meet in a district meeting to determine issues that might relate to elections, the Attorney General of the United States basically has a seat in the room with them and gets to veto whatever it is that they can do. So you have a federal veto over state and local enactments that relate to voting practices.
Attorney Gregory Coleman argued on behalf of the Texas district.
There's no basis for that anymore. You cannot any longer justify a presumption that these people can't be trusted to act in good faith to protect the voting rights of everybody. And that's really what we're saying, is that you shouldn't presume that people can't be trusted.
The appellees say Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006 because it found, after 21 hearings and 10 months of investigation, that although voting rights have improved since 1964, protections are still necessary. Debo Adebile argued on behalf of the appellees.
And we've seen that discrimination takes root. It grows back. The weeds are still there, and it will come back, and minority communities will be disadvantaged. There will be more discrimination. There will be fewer minority elected officials. There will be more moved polling places. They will play hide the polling place on the eve of an election. Politics and voting is about power. And when the rules of the game can be manipulated, free from fair rules, that power will lead to bad effects.
Justice Anthony Kennedy could be the crucial justice in this decision. He was vocal during the argument, concerned that Congress only subjects some states to federal oversight.
The Congress has made a finding that the sovereignty of Georgia is less than the sovereign dignity of Ohio. The sovereignty of Alabama is less than the sovereign dignity of Michigan, and that the governments in one are to be trusted in, less than the governments in the other. But this is a great disparity in treatment, and the government of the United States is saying that our states must be treated differently. And you have a very substantial burden if you're going to make that case.
The Supreme Court has ruled on this issue before, upholding voting rights each time. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Recent figures indicate at least 128 people died attempting to cross the Mexican border with the U.S. during a six-month period ending in March. Federal officials admit that high counts of deaths year after year, including more than 500 in 2005, don't correspond to an increase in people attempting to cross the border. As John Han reports, some say these statistics are proof the U.S. should reform its border policies.
While the arrest of undocumented immigrants may be down, the death count is up. Reverend Robert Hoover is the founder of Humane Borders, an Arizona-based organization that provides water stations to migrants in the desert. He says increased Border Patrol agents, border fences, and surveillance technology are pushing migrants into more dangerous terrain as a point of entry into the United States.
The migrants are walking in more corrugated sort of terrain, up and down, having to walk in thicker brush, different kinds of things. It's more difficult. So if you walk a more circuitous route around the fences, around the towers, around the cameras, around the Border Patrol agents that you see deployed, you're exposed to the elements for a longer period of time. And that plus the terrain multiplies the possibility that a turned ankle or something like that ends up being a death sentence.
U.S. Border Patrol's Lloyd Easterling says it's inaccurate to blame the deaths of undocumented immigrants on the increased border security.
We have more agents in more places more frequently with our increase in manpower. And a lot of what we have found have been skeletal remains, and we don't know how long those have been out there. So to say that it's attributable to an increased enforcement posture, I think is off base.
Andrea Guerrero is the field and policy director at the ACLU in San Diego. She adds this caution.
This office and many others get regular reports of abuse perpetrated by Border Patrol and ICE agents directed at not only migrants, but border residents and citizens alike. And we have, in fact, seen an increase in these abuses since the beginning of 2009. So we're very concerned that border enforcement agencies are allowed to act with impunity and are running amok over the rights, the human rights and civil rights of border communities.
Immigrants' rights advocates are calling for increasing the number of visas for migrant workers and legalizing undocumented workers currently living and working in the United States. Additionally, advocates support economic development in Mexico and beginning a guest worker program that would not limit migrant workers to a single employer or sector of the economy. John Hahn, Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org. Coming up later, we'll hear how a global recession is motivating Japanese Brazilians to return to Brazil. I'm Ara Bogado. Stay tuned. Increasingly high levels of violence are creating a security crisis in El Salvador. FSRN's Ricardo Martinez is in San Salvador, where he takes a look at the weak economy coupled with deportations from the United States. Both are fueling a hub of violence in Central America.
In the civil war ravaged El Salvador, guns are at the center of daily violence. In March alone, at least 340 people were killed by gunfire, according to the National Civilian Police of El Salvador. Guns such as Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13, operate beyond the borders. It originated in Los Angeles in the 1980s and spread to Central America and various parts of the United States over the years. The gang is composed mostly of Salvadorans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, and Nicaraguans. Today, the murder rate in each of these Central American countries is higher than that of Colombia, once known as the murder capital of Latin America. Carlos Castaneda is a Congress member. He says two components have created the security crisis: the lack of opportunities for young people and the mass deportation of thousands from the United States.
Lo que se impone son las deportaciones. Cerramos 2008.
The deportations have continued. At the end of 2008, there had been 28,000 deportations to El Salvador. The Republic of Guatemala ended with 50,000 deportations, and Honduras with 30,000 deportations. What will the future look like for our youth when we are in this kind of condition, especially when there is no eligibility for government programs or state programs? What remains for our youth, boys and girls, when they return to El Salvador? They join gangs to commit crimes because there is not a place that allows them a better life. That is the future we have.
Delinquir porque no hay una ubicación que les permita esa vida digna. Ese es el futuro que tenemos.
Salvadoran police report that 90% of gang members deported from the United States find a way to return to the United States. Alfredo Tovar is a social analyst. He studied social phenomena since the end of the war in 1992.
La mayoría de migrantes se van, algunos con antecedentes ya penales y algunos tal vez porque no encuentran empleo optan por.
Most of the migrants in the U.S. have criminal records because they cannot find work. They choose to engage in illegal activities in criminal groups that require them to do criminal acts. And they like it, and they like it because it is easy money. Sometimes they earn a lot of money. The problem is that the United States has a policy of persecution of all such actions. Many of these people are caught and sent back to our country. And this is where the situation is worse, because they return to our country with criminal backgrounds. And here in El Salvador, it's fertile ground without employment opportunities. They continue their criminal activities.
Encontrar el escenario fértil sin oportunidad de empleo, entonces vienen a continuar sus acciones delictivas.
The mass deportation from the United States raised tensions back home in El Salvador. 40% of 6 million people are unemployed, making El Salvador the second poorest in Latin America after Haiti. This poverty drives people to the United States in search of opportunities. Carlos Castaneda explains.
Miles de jóvenes, muchachas y muchachos de nuestro país.
Thousands of young boys and girls from our country, from the Central American region, are forced by necessity, the lack of job placements and social opportunities, to abandon their families and abandon their children.
Abandonar a su familia, a sus hijos.
Thus, thousands of young people made desperate attempts to pursue the so-called American dream. Now, with the American dream shaken up, the immigrant dreams also are shattered. Will Lopez, a young man, reached the United States in 2005, but was recently deported back by the immigration authorities.
The reason I immigrated was first for my family, to try and help them and move us forward. I lived for 4 years in the United States, and I did construction work. Returning for work one day with my co-workers, there was a raid and we were arrested. It's bad for me and for the majority of young people that have experienced something similar to me. While I was working, I also dealt with the danger of living in the street because of migration.
Will Lopez plans to return to the USA, but it is men like him, dejected and unemployed, who end up in the gangs in Central America and the USA. Today, MS-13 has between 6,000 and 10,000 members in the United States, according to the USA Immigration and Naturalization Service. It has grown moderately in recent years and now has a presence in 43 states. Since 2005, the USA immigration authorities arrested about 2,000 members of the gang. About 13% of them were deported, while the rest wait for legal resolution in jails. Ricardo Martinez, San Salvador, Free Speech Radio News.
Some 100 years ago, a wave of poor Japanese migrants resettled in Brazil to work on coffee plantations. Today, their descendants number around 1 million and are one of Brazil's most successful minority groups. In the 1990s, Japan offered these descendants work visas, and close to 300,000 Japanese Brazilians have since returned to their ancestral homeland. FSRN's Jason Strother is in Nagoya, where he reports that now, due to a global economic recession, many are heading back to Brazil.
A team of assembly line workers operate drill presses at a factory that makes car parts for Japan's automotive giants like Toyota and Honda. In many such units, the workforce is made up of Brazilian laborers whose ancestors migrated from Japan beginning in 1908. They are known as the Nikkei. Since 1990, when Japan began offering visas to this diaspora, entire families have come here to find work, like that of 26-year-old Alessandra Yamada. She shares an apartment with her brother and sister in Nagoya. Their mother works in a town a couple hours away. Even though Yamada earned a university degree back in Brazil, she says the Japanese work visa gave her more opportunities.
We can get a better salary here than in Brazil. The reality of the Brazilian economy is that even people with university degrees cannot earn as much as compared to in Japan. We can save money here too.
Brazilians like Yamada have filled a void in the labor market. Japan, with its shrinking population, does not have a large enough workforce, nor one with the desire to take these types of low-skilled and low-paying jobs. But even though Japan offers visas to people specifically because of their ethnic ancestry, many say they are not treated as equals. Angelo Ishii is an associate professor of sociology at Musashi University in Tokyo and third-generation Nikkei. He says back in Brazil, the Japanese live within the middle class and are regarded as a model immigrant community and are now well integrated into society. But that all changes once they accept jobs here in Japan.
And then in Japan, so they face a very different situation because they are in the lowest part of Japanese society pyramid. They are doing the worst job. They are treated like only a good workforce, nothing more than that.
Ishii adds that despite these obstacles, many Brazilians choose to stay in Japan, not just for the money, but because of the comfort and safety that life here offers. But now, as Japan faces its worst economic downturn in decades, many Nikkei migrant workers are being forced to return to Brazil. Since the recession began in November, companies have laid off hundreds of thousands of workers, and Brazilian migrants have been the first to lose their jobs. 28-year-old Karina Sonoda has worked in Japan for almost 8 years. She says she was sacked without warning from her job at a car parts factory.
And my Japanese boss just told me, okay, from Monday, you are on vacation. But on Tuesday the next day, he told my manager, my Brazilian boss, that he had to dismiss. So that's it. Next day, he told me I was fired.
Economists predict that half of the estimated 300,000 Nikkei could be laid off this year. Already, the recession's impact is visible in the businesses and schools that serve the Brazilian community. The children of factory workers play in the gymnasium of their Portuguese language elementary school. The school's director, Ariel Magno Watanabe, says before the crisis, there were around 150 tuition-paying students here. Now, there are 35. Watanabe says in order to keep his school open, he hopes to combine classes with another school in Nagoya. He says he's very worried about losing more students as families leave for Brazil. But things might not be any easier for the Nikkei once they get back home. Unemployment in Brazil hovers around 8%, and the type of low-skilled labor they've done in Japan won't help them get jobs there. Again, Musashi University's Angelo Ishii.
He or she cannot search for some skilled job in the same conditions of people that have studied there and people that are looking for the same job there.
Recently laid off Karina Sonoda says she's been thinking a lot about what she'll do if and when she leaves Japan for good.
I really feel scared. And it's strange because I will restart my life. I'll try to go to college and try to find a job there.
Do you think it'll be easy for you to find a job when you go back to Brazil?
The situation there hasn't changed, but it's a little bit better now. But I'm sure it's not going to be easy, but I will try.
And to avoid what it calls a growing social problem, Japan's Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare is offering money to unemployed Nikkei so they can buy one-way tickets back to Brazil. Jason Strother, FSRN, Nagoya, Japan.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Rose Katabchi and Elena Botkin-Levy. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.